The tribunal analyzed all the investigation made by the PGR, and they said in all these more than 700 pages of this resolution, they determined that the Mexican government didn't do a good investigation. They said that even exist many depositions, many testimonies, many elements to investigate immediately to the army and to the federal police, the PGR didn't. So they said that this really affect the investigation since the beginning. They also said, Amy, as we have been talking about this before, as you know, I have been investigating this case since October of 2014. I was the first journalist that discovered that in Iguala was the presence of the army and the federal police in all the attacks. As you know, I discovered that exists in Iguala this C4. It's a kind of big office where all the institutions related with the public security, as municipal police, state police, army, federal police, were all together coordinated that terrible night.
Good afternoon. The time is 5 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and up next is the KBOO Evening News.
Don't worry. I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some fun.
Dearly beloved,
oh yeah, come ride and dance with Diablo all over Portland as we celebrate Prince's birthday on Thursday, June 7th at 8 p.m. with a mobile bicycle dance party. We'll be rocking Pedalpalooza and dropping the Prince jams all night long with frequent dance stops. Once again, that's Prince's birthday bike ride celebration, Thursday, June 7th at 8 p.m. More information on the KBOO website under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Village Building Convergence, taking place June 1st through 10th at locations all over Portland. The Village Building Convergence features over 30 community-built projects happening all over Portland, including the Mudbone Community Farm, Sherritt Square, and Portland University. Additionally, there are also ticketed evening events featuring speakers and local musicians. Again, that's the Village Building Convergence, taking place June 1st through 10th at locations all over Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, PSU students against sexual violence continue to protest on campus.
ICE detains a pizza delivery man.
And in international news, Volcano Pacaya near Volcano Fuego erupts.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 7th, 2018. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. KBOO News would like to give a content warning for this next piece, which contains sensitive information about assault, abuse, and rape. PSU students, backed by several on-campus organizations, are still protesting PSU's inaction in regards to who they say is a serial rapist currently enrolled in its programs. Despite multiple reports and an investigation by the International Socialist Organization, on May 31st, more than 12 university students swarmed the eighth floor lobby of the university's Market Center building with the intention of delivering 1,300 signatures to PSU's Title IX Coordinator Julie Caron. PSU's Interim Vice President for Global Diversity, Michael Alexander, met the protesters who were there in support of Tess Carter, one of the rape victim survivors who has come forward. Alexander told the crowd that Caron was not in for the day. KBOO News recently spoke with Carter, who said that she had gone through the formal process of filing a complaint to initiate an official investigation over 5 months ago, and that since the initial first meeting with university staff in January, has heard nothing back about the outcome. The International Socialist Organization, which Tess Carter says her rapist was a member of, completed an investigation themselves after receiving Carter's complaint and immediately expelled her assaulter from the organization after receiving what they say was compelling proof from multiple sources and witnesses.
Last April, a group of students interrupted a class that Carter's assaulter was in order to warn fellow students. PSU dispatched armed campus police officers to the action. Some students were slapped with a code of conduct violation, including Carter, for the protest, and are now on disciplinary probation until May 1, 2019, and expected to complete 25 hours of community service. They are also required to write an essay on how they failed to uphold Portland State University policies. Protests continue on campus from those demanding that PSU issue a statement on the matter, rescind their disciplinary action towards the survivors and protesters and Carter's assaulter. PSU, after several weeks of withholding comments, said in statements to the press that it is not able to disclose details of investigations due to federal privacy laws. KBOO's Zelos Marchant spoke with Camille from the International Socialist Organization last week about PSU's silence on the matter and the continuing protests.
Hey, I am talking with Camille from the International Socialist Organization about the PSU Students Against Sexual Violence campaign happening right now. Camille, thank you for joining KBOO in our audience and for coming on KBOO to talk about these really deep issues.
Yeah, thank you for contacting us and following up for the news.
Absolutely. So we ran a story earlier. Tess, one of the women involved, one of the women impacted by what she called serial rapist, and was brave enough to talk to us about what has happened to her, what has happened to two other women that have come forward. And I understand that there was an action today at PSU about that.
Yes. So today was like the last of three actions that had been planned for this week. We started out with a rally on Tuesday from 11 to noon, and then a march on Tuesday as well, where the main focus was collecting signatures for the petition demanding that PSU expel the serial rapist that Tess mentioned, and then drop the disciplinary actions against students who participated in a call out against the person, Hannah Eid. And the university has known for over 6 months about this person who has assaulted multiple women, raped multiple women, and seemingly has done nothing, while they almost immediately turned around and the students involved in the call out against this predator had disciplinary actions against them within a week and a half, 2 weeks.
So just to get on the same page, so the women were disciplined for just peaceably protesting to say, hey, there's somebody dangerous on campus, we've submitted information to you, and PSU, what's your answer? To which PSU then just slapped them with some disciplinary action.
Yeah, so the initial action, and sorry, I guess I kind of got off track, but there were two other actions this week, one on Wednesday at noon, and then today at noon we delivered around 1,300 signatures that we've collected so far ended up being Michael, his last name has escaped me, but the people that we were trying to go see, their offices were closed and they are not on campus, magically today. So we were met with somebody else, Michael Alexander, that's his name. And there's a video on the Portland, the PSU Student Union's website. But yes, the initial, to actually answer your question, is the initial action. There were 8 students that participated in a call out during the accused rapist class, and they were immediately escorted off campus by campus security, which are armed police now, that were armed in the name of sexual violence, though I doubt that they've done anything to curb it. At Portland State University. And then those are the students. So it doesn't actually include any of the survivors, but there's students that were standing in solidarity with the survivors. And so at least 3 of those students have had disciplinary actions put against them, demanding that they do 25 hours of community service, write an essay basically admitting to PSU that they did something wrong, and then are going to be on academic probation in the fall.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So there's obviously a discrepancy. You know, they come down hard on activism, but apparently sexual violence is fine on campus.
Wow. Since the actions, has there been any statement from Portland State University, the dean, different groups who are supporting the PSU's stance on this at all?
No official statements from what I know. Mm-hmm. but Michael Alexander had a number of empty things to say to us today. One of the chants that ended up happening today was, "Your words mean nothing, take action." Because unfortunately, as many university administrators I've seen over the years, he made empty platitudes, but had nothing concrete.
So define more what empty platitudes and empty words mean. I mean, it sounds like you're implying there's some performative aspects to the situation where he's saying, "Oh yeah, we'll get to it," or can you elaborate more on his casual wording around the situation?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a lot of intense emotion, so I'm not sure how many details I remember, sure. But I do remember him saying, just not saying that they would do anything. He was very careful, it seemed, to not encourage. I'm not sure how to put it.
Just non-committal statements.
Yeah, he was non-committal, and he said something like that. I actually think is quoted in the Oregon Public Broadcasting piece. That he said something like, "I hear you. I believe your truth," but didn't have anything concrete. To me, it seemed insulting.
Did Michael Alexander say in either the OPB piece or to you casually and other organizers or even to the women that PSU is still investigating?
He did not say. He said that he wasn't able to comment on the case specifically. Because he's not actually... The person that we wanted to meet with was the Title IX coordinator, Julie Karen. And she was not in the office. And the office was locked as well.
Well, wow. That's all I can say after hearing that. incredible. Seems like a shutdown of communication on something that should be a lot more transparent. So there was a rally earlier today at noon. How did that go? Apart from the offices you're telling me were shut. People were not there.
you know, it's like I guess, big bad students. But it went pretty well. I would say it's like there were probably 30 or more people who came with Tess to deliver the petitions, the signatures that we had collected. Pretty much in like 6 days, we collected 1,300 signatures in person and online, which is like 200 a day. So we're still collecting them. Hopefully we can get a lot more than that. But we delivered them to the university, and it was pretty, like, spirited but serious. Somebody else who's been helping out with this, Elissa Pagan, who's in Socialist Alternative, that she was saying kind of on the first day and then also today, we don't want to be here, but we have to be here, and that, I think, is absolutely true, because the university has done nothing, apparently has done nothing, and has no answer for the survivors, which includes a student who for now wishes to remain anonymous, but has been one of the leading organizers of this campaign, along with Tess, like Tess herself, and then survivors of this person's sexual violence have been the main driving force behind this organizing campaign.
That was KBOO's Zelos Marchant speaking with Camille White-Avian from the International Socialist Organization about the PSU Students Against Sexual Violence protests.
The most current action planned in support of Tess Carter and others who have come forward about their experiences being assaulted on campus took place this morning at the PSU Smith Park blocks to Smith Center, room 433, Office of the Dean of Student Life. It was a second attempt to deliver a petition to the administrators and was organized by the PSU Students Against Sexual Violence. Multiple organizations are endorsing the petition, and actions to deliver it, including PSU Rapid Response Mobilization Network, Jobs with Justice, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA, and Portland Young Democratic Socialist of America. The petition is still open to those wishing to support this action. More information can be found searching PSU Students Against Sexual Violence on Facebook.
Last Friday, around 11 a.m., Pablo Villavicencio was detained by ICE at an army base in Brooklyn, New York. According to ABC News, Villavicencio delivered a pizza to Fort Hamilton Military Base in Brooklyn, where he was detained. Brooklyn Councilman Justin Brannon represents the district in which the arrest occurred. Brannon claims that, quote, in the past, Villavicencio had entered the base with his New York City ID, end quote. Per Heavy News, upon his arrival, Villavicencio was pressed by a guard who, quote, demanded more identification, end quote. He signed a waiver allowing the base to conduct a background check. The guard continued to press Villavicencio, who claims, quote, the guard called the NYPD, and the NYPD told him I didn't have any record and that I was clean. But the man said, I don't care. He said, I need to keep waiting, and he called ICE, end quote. During the check, officials at the base discovered that ICE had an active warrant out for Villavicencio. The base turned Villavicencio over to ICE, who are now holding him in New Jersey. Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams and Councilman Brannon are working with the Villavicencio family to determine exactly what occurred at the military base. Villavicencio, his wife, Sandra Chica, asked, how is it possible that in New York City, now the soldiers change their role to that of intermediaries of the immigration agents? Chica is a naturalized U.S. citizen, while the couple's two daughters were both born in the U.S. She applied for permanent residency on behalf of her husband last February. A GoFundMe strategy in support of Villavicencio and his family has raised over $11,000. At a press conference, Councilman Brannon posed a question to reporters, quote, Is our city, state, and nation any safer today because they took a pizza delivery guy off the streets? End quote. Villavicencio is now at risk of deportation.
Up next is up-to-the-minute news from the Guatemala concerning Volcano Fuego. KBOO News spoke with a disaster relief official in the country who gave KBOO News an up-to-date account of the status of the Fuego this afternoon and told us about the new volcanic activity beginning to at the nearby volcano Pacaya. Here's that report.
KBOO News spoke earlier this afternoon with Francisco Toledo, in charge of monitoring the volcano relief activities for Guatemala's FEMA-like organization, CONRED. Francisco gave us up-to-date information about the eruption of Fuego, and he told us about a second volcano active now, Pacaya.
After 3 days, 72 hours of search and rescue activities, all that type of actions have been stopped accordingly to the protocols approved in this type of situations. The activity of search and rescue is only related to dead people or body recovery.
How many deaths have there been?
As this time, the latest information refers to 101 people dead, 197 missing people, and approximately 1,700,000 persons being affected by the phenomena. It's just over 7-8 million people all together.
Francisco, why have the operations been suspended? Is that what you said?
There is a protocol, an international protocol, the search and rescue teams. You go for searching live people for only 3 days, 72 hours is the longest time elapsing that you can actually find, or at least try to find live people.
Is the volcano still erupting?
The volcano, right now, it's been a little bit low in activity. But it's, every now and then, a couple of puffs there. And the area of Pacaya is also active now. Since yesterday, Natural Weather Service notify us of activity in volcano, in Pacaya volcano, which is towards the east of volcano of the Fuego. They are not related each other in this activity. It's independent lava flows and things like that.
How many people are involved in the rescue effort?
An average that were involved, I would say more than 800 rescuers, the fire department, CONRED, the army, and personnel from volunteer organizations in the police department all together. But exactly for search and rescue people, there were more than 600 to 700 rescuers.
Are you getting the help you need from other countries, including the United States?
There have been a lot of offers for help and supplies and things like that. But there's a procedure that has to be followed by international laws. And when that document is all approved by the government and National Congress, then the international aid may come in and flow. Meanwhile, we're working with local suppliers, and things are being carried on.
Are you getting any help from the United States?
Yes, there have been some offers. The thing is, there has to be a procedure done to be followed to comply with the law and the international treaties concerning the type of aid that we need, because otherwise there are a lot of things that are useless completely, as happened in another times instead of what actually we need.
What's the next step for your organization?
Well, we keep on searching, and body recover. It's very seldom that we might find some alive people. And now we began to locate the areas that can be rebuilt, and the updating of the evacuation routes, and special areas to be concerned in case of, again, the volcano gets active. We never know after this sudden explosion of 3 days ago.
We heard on the BBC News this morning that the head of the operation of rescue and disaster response had been fired from the government. Is that correct?
That's a special thing to be talked about. But there is a lack of proper communication in between the beginning, and that's entirely a local matter, which is being handled in a different area and to the legal procedures and follow-up.
In the context of Guatemalan history, how bad is this particular disaster?
Considering the activity, the volcanic activity here in Guatemala, I would say that this would be one of the most dangerous and strongest volcanic eruptions that we've had. It, all of a sudden, the volcano had eruptions more than what? 6-7 years ago, several eruptions, ash fall, and things like that. But this one was a very strong one, only compared with the one held in 1974.
Is there anything you want to add that I should have asked you about?
Things are very rough now, all the way in the volcanic area. People are being affected, but we'll come to it.
Well, we wish you the best, and thank you again for your time.
Bye-bye.
That was KBOO News speaking this afternoon with Francisco Toledo, monitoring officer with CONRED, the Guatemalan agency responsible for monitoring disaster relief. For KBOO News, this is Tom Flynn. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Ibrahim Mubarak, the Pitch Tent Event Coordinator for Downtown this weekend. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather in Portland and east of the Cascades will be cloudy with a low of around 53 degrees, followed by showers. Today in history, in the year 1948, Edvard Beneš resigned as the president of Czechoslovakia instead of signing the Month of May Constitution, which effectively turned his country into a communist state of the Soviet Union. Beneš died just 1 year later. The quote of the day is from Czech writer Milan Kundera, quote, "In the realm of totalitarian kitsch, all answers are given in advance and preclude any questions. It follows, then, that the true opponent of totalitarian kitsch is the person who asks questions. A question is like a knife that slices through the stage backdrop and gives us a look at what lies behind it."
On Sunday, June 3rd, almost exactly 1 year since last June's violent altercation, alt-right and anti-fascist protest groups clashed once again in Portland. Patriot Prayer was led by a notorious alt-right leader, Joey Gibson, and accompanied by the Proud Boys, a violent group that serves as protection to alt-right rallies and protests. Rose City Antifa, a local chapter of the anti-fascist movement Antifa, were present at the protest to counter the white nationalist message. Multiple known white nationalists attended the alt-right protest. Rose City Antifa has conducted an exhaustive investigation into the movements of the Proud Boys white nationalist group in the Pacific Northwest. The investigation will also provide in-depth information concerning the individuals involved in the Proud Boys group. The first installment of the report was released yesterday. Rose City Antifa will release the report in multiple segments throughout this summer.
According to the Oregonian, Housing Secretary Ben Carson's federal housing proposal would bring greater financial hardship for poor Americans. Carson proposes to raise rents for most Americans receiving federal housing assistance. On average, such households would see an increase of over 20% in the cost of rent. Carson says the proposal is, quote, our attempt to give poor people a way out of poverty, end quote. As Carson sees it, higher rent will encourage those receiving federal assistance to find more work. For some, like Ebony Morris and her four children living in Charleston, South Carolina, the proposal could mean homelessness. Morris says, quote, I saw public housing as an option to get on my feet, to pay 30% of my income and get myself out of debt and eventually become a homeowner, end quote. Morris's rent would jump from $403 to $600 if the proposal passes. Melissa Maddox Evans, the general counsel for Charleston's Housing Authority, rejects Carson's idea that those on public housing do not work. Evans claims that most tenants in Charleston already work two or three jobs. Across the U.S. 100 largest cities, tenants with federal housing assistance would pay about 20% more on rent each year. The increase in rent price would outpace growth in average hourly earnings about six times over. In Portland, rent for low-income households would increase $590 per year, an increase of 15.6%. About 4 million households receiving assistance would be impacted if the proposal is approved in Congress. An analysis of the impacts of the proposal demonstrates that households with children would be far more vulnerable than others receiving federal assistance. Morris works 50 hours each week to pay the bills to support her children and believes that if the proposal is approved, she may not be able to pay for her kids' extracurriculars or for internet in the home, which would severely impact her children's ability to do homework. Low-income residents in Washington, D.C. would experience a $980 per year hike in rent, the nation's highest spike. Diane Yentl, CEO of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, asserts that, quote, this proposal to raise rents on low-income people doesn't magically create well-paying jobs needed to lift people out of poverty. Instead, it just makes it harder for struggling families to get ahead by potentially cutting them off from the very stability that makes it possible for them to find and keep jobs. The Department of Housing and Urban Development also says that the elderly and those with disabilities would not be impacted by the proposed rent hike, but the analysis of the proposal shows that the 314,000 of such households could lose their exempt status that would spare them from the rent increase. The proposal would also increase minimum rent from $50 to $150. The analysis of Carson's proposal is based on 2016 data from the Department of Housing and Urban Development.
IKEA has recently published a plan to eliminate all single-use plastic from all its available products by 2020. The international retailer introduces the plan amidst mounting concerns surrounding the effects of plastic waste. IKEA announced that all plastics, straws, plates, cups, garbage bags, freezer bags, and anything coated in plastic would be eliminated from stock and, if possible, replaced by alternatives by 2020. An IKEA spokesperson announced that we don't all have the answers yet, but we are working together with our suppliers to find solutions that are good for both people and the planet. The furniture company, which has 363 stores worldwide, has already announced that by August of 2020, all oil-based plastics will be eliminated from its products, and any remaining plastic products will be made using recycled material. IKEA has already funded the creation of a plastic recycling plant in order to meet their 18-month deadline. Beyond their plan for plastics, IKEA is offering customers a tap nozzle that can save more than 90% of water used. And by 2025, IKEA will offer solar panels across almost 30 markets. It currently offers such panels in 5 markets. IKEA has also invested in wind farms, and its stores are equipped with solar panels. Torbjorn Lof, the chief executive of Inter-IKEA Group, the parent company of IKEA, announced that change will only be possible if we collaborate with others and nurture entrepreneurship. We are committed to taking the lead, working together with everyone from raw material suppliers all the way to our customers and partners.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Canadian government has given an extension to the mandate of the commission investigating missing and murdered Indigenous women. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, the extension falls well short of what the commissioners had asked for.
The federal government says 6 months should be enough for the commission to complete its work. That includes hearings and a final report. The inquiry now has until April of next year. But that isn't sitting well with the commissioners, who say the six-month extension does a disservice to the victims, survivors, and families. Marion Buller is the chief commissioner.
Very, very disappointed. We put a lot of work into our request for the two-year extension. It was well analyzed, well thought out, fact-based. And, of course, it was very disappointing to have the government dismiss that recommendation, or that request, rather, for additional time.
Buller says in asking for 2 years and an extra $50 million, the commission was striking a balance between the urgency of the issues and the need to do the work thoroughly. She adds that it now appears that political expediency has been given priority over the safety of Indigenous women and girls. But Minister Bennett says the decision to grant only a six-month extension was made partly because the provinces and territories were not unanimous in supporting anything longer. She also says the decisions came after consultations with survivors, families, and Indigenous groups, as well as the provinces and territories. The Commission's final report is due in April, and it will have until the end of June to wind down its operations. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Dozens of people recently turned out in Kodiak, Alaska, to celebrate the groundbreaking for a new downtown park. Aleutic Ancestors Memorial Park commemorates the ancestors of Aleutic people whose remains were removed from the archipelago and are being returned. Daisha Eaton with KMXT reports.
That's the sound of the Kodiak Aleutic dancers ushering in Aleutic Ancestors Memorial Park in downtown Kodiak. The dancers performed a set of songs and dances welcoming the return of some of their ancestors. Susan Malutin, whose great-grandmother was from Chirikoff Island near Kodiak, attended the groundbreaking.
You know, it felt sad and happy at the same time. Sad because what a long, long journey they had to take in order to get back home. And then happy because they are home.
Last year, after a long struggle, Kodiak's Aleutic Museum and Archaeological Repository was successful in securing the return of more than 100 individual remains back to the island from the University of Indiana. The Chirikoff remains were repatriated under a federal act called NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. It calls for any organization that receives federal funding to return remains in their care. Over the past 200 years, museums and archaeologists removed more than 1,000 remains of Aleutic people from the Kodiak area. The park tells this story and celebrates their return. April Lactonen Counselor is Aleutic and Executive Director of the Aleutic Museum.
We're probably talking about up to 1,200 people that have been returned home so far for reburial, and we want the larger community to understand the scope of this issue.
At the center of the memorial, there will be a large concrete ring, a shape representing the passageway between the spirit world and the regular world in Aleutic culture, containing a mass planting of blue forget-me-nots. Counselor says she hopes her people's success can serve as a model for other Indigenous communities. Construction of the park is scheduled to take place over the summer. In Kodiak, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You might not know it, but the Olympic torchbearers are not the only international torchbearers for peace. In 1987, Sri Chinmoy founded the Oneness Peace Run, a global torch relay for peace. Today, there are over 150 countries that participate in the event, spanning 400,000 miles. This weekend, the Global Torch for Peace passes through Portland, Oregon, and coincides with the 30-year anniversary of Oregon Outreach and the Gladys McCoy School. The torchbearers will pass the torch to Portland resident Ray Fields. Food, music, and other entertainment will close out the torch ceremony and the graduation ceremony of the Gladys McCoy Class of 2018. KBOO's Celos Marchand spoke with the Oregon Outreach Executive Director, Rebecca Black, to find out more.
All right, I have in the studio Rebecca Black, founder and director of Oregon Outreach, Inc. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having
me. We've got
me.
A lot to talk about. Your organization sounds really awesome. I know it's also part and parcel of the Gladys McCoy Academy, but let's start with Oregon Outreach. What's going on over there?
I founded it 30 years ago in 1988, and we provide accredited alternative schools for underserved youth who have dropped out of school or who are struggling, and we provide an alternative and a choice for them. So our first school and our oldest is the Gladys McCoy Academy here in Northeast Portland. We also have programs in the rural area in Malala, Scappoose, and Vernonia. And again, in all those programs, we serve those students who are struggling. And part of our event, we're having a twofold event on Sunday, and one is our 30th anniversary. The middle of June is our 30th anniversary. And then we're also welcoming the Peace Run torchbearers at that same event.
Awesome. I had no idea that you had little satellites out there, Malala, Scappoose, and Vernonia. I used to live out in Scappoose.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I'm a rural brat. Totally.
Well, that's great. And then we have students from Rainier. And so we're finding that a lot of the districts in rural areas don't have a lot of options for their students. And so we're happy to be out there and offering that alternative to those students that most likely would not graduate without some special help.
Oh, that's really wonderful. So let's dive into the 30th anniversary that you're going to be celebrating here and the Freedom Flame. I've been telling everybody about this Freedom Flame. Take us away.
It's very exciting. I've been working with this group for about 4 years, and it's a peace run which was organized started in 1987 by Sri Chinmoy. I have a hard time pronouncing his name. He was a peace advocate. I'm going to read you what he said. He's no longer alive, but he established this, and he said, "Everything I am doing is aimed at one goal, the establishment of a oneness family founded upon peace. If I have peace and you have peace and everybody has peace, then only can we have a oneness family." So he started a process where there are runners all over the world who carry a peace torch, and they run from town to town, and they identify people in those towns that have contributed to peace, to building a better community and a more peaceful world, and they stop and pass the torch on to them and give them a medal. And it's interesting that here in Portland, very few people have heard about the Peace Run, and you need to check out their website. They're all over the world. And the 12 runners who will be here are running across America. They're from all over the world, and they stop in towns and award the torch or pass the torch on. And so this year here in Portland, they're giving it to a gentleman, Ray Fields, who is a 55-year member of the Rotarians. He has perfect attendance for 55 years, and during that time, he has sponsored exchange students. He has helped raise money to send exchange students from this country to other countries when their parents can't afford it. He started a fund to help them. Right after the ceremony on Sunday, he's picking up an exchange student at the airport that he's hosting. And then, in addition, he's on the board of Oregon Outreach and is helping us work really hard to keep our doors open, because in Portland, we don't receive any funding from Portland Public Schools. Our other schools receive funding from districts, but not in Portland. So he's a big asset. And something he is okay with me sharing, that he was diagnosed with terminal cancer over a year ago, and he's lived way beyond when they said he could, and he's still not missed a Rotary meeting, and he's still out there doing good works. And so they're passing the torch on to Ray. He's 80 years old. He's going to be there, and we're excited to see him get this this award.
That's incredible. That's not one meeting, huh? You didn't miss a single one? That's incredible.
How do you do that? I can't do a month without missing something, but right. It is pretty incredible, and it hasn't slowed him down. He arranges his chemo and everything on other days, and he always tells the doctor, I got to go to Rotary on Wednesday, so he can't mess with my Wednesday meeting. So it's been really amazing to meet him and see what he's quietly done.
What a big heart.
Yes. Yes, very
giant
much
soul.
So.
Yeah.
And I just wish more of Portland was aware of the Peace Run and would honor these people when they pass through our town. For 4 years, I've arranged to feed them and greet them and try to make them feel welcome. But not many people in the community know about this event.
Hopefully that will change.
It's huge. I hope
so. Yeah. How many nations are they coming from? Obviously, they're kind of all over.
You know, I'm always forgetting the number. It's like 140 countries around the world have runners in them.
Okay.
And this torch has been passed to Nelson Mandela, to Mother Teresa, to Pope Francis, to Billie Jean King, some people that have done amazing things. And when we told Ray about this, who's getting the torch this year, he said, I guess I'm an underachiever because these other people have done a lot. No, there's no underachievers
out
there in
the community.
If
you're listening, I think you're really spot on there. Great. I kind of have a funny question. Do the runners get to sleep between?
They do.
between
there
the
is,
torch
they camp a lot. They sleep outside a lot when there's places to do that. There is a van. And then there are places that invite them to stay when they pass through cities. Here they're going to have to sleep outside or sleep in a van because we don't have accommodations for 12 of them. And a lot of times there will be a runner who maybe is running in America or another country and their families live somewhere the runners are going through and they arrange for them to sleep. But they're amazing and really good shape.
I bet they are. I bet they are. Well, this is a great time to be running through Oregon. That's for
Absolutely.
Sure. Very mild temperatures for one.
Yes. There'll be rain on Sunday, so we'll have a tent
okay.
and a big tree people can sit under at our event. And by the way, the event is on the campus of Warner Pacific University at from 4:30 to 7 on Sunday. The runners will arrive in Portland at our event about 6 o'clock. And the address is 68th and Division.
Okay, that's great. How can our listeners support your organization, Oregon Outreach, Inc., the Freedom Flame runners, all of that? It's just
well,
so inspiring.
Well, we would love to have them come out and be there to greet the runners and to help us celebrate. We're going to have lots of food and music, and it would be great to see members of the community come out and be there to help greet the runners and meet them and hear their stories and just to help us celebrate.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and news tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is C.J. Fritz and Tom Flynn. Special thanks to Native Voice One, the producer, engineer, and KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is that Renaissance person, Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Positively Revolting, Ani takes your calls. At 9, on The Beloved Community, Professor Paul Ortiz talks about his book, African American and Latinx History of the United States. At 10, Valley Views is back with more tips on eating to live a healthy life. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Digital Divide listens to the third annual Andrew Carnegie Lecture at Edinburgh College of Art, delivered by musician and producer Brian Eno. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Many think of the Rose Festival as a fun event bringing lots of different people together to celebrate the City of Roses, but housing advocates say that the city practice of allowing housed people to camp overnight in order to save a seat for the Rose Festival parade the next day is hypocritical to those who are houseless. Ibrahim Mubarak from KBOO's Right to Survive began the Pitch a Tent event about 8 years ago to bring this issue into the mainstream. He joins us on over the phone today. Welcome.
Welcome, thank you. And I have Leo Rose with me, one of the originators from Pitch a Tent. So we're going to tag team y'all.
Okay. So what was the first Pitch a Tent like?
Oh, man, it was amazing, really. I'm the founder of that. But it was really amazing. A lot of good people coming on out. One of the things, though, that happened was the cops came and told us we couldn't pitch our tents because we looked homeless. And they were trying to tell us to leave. And we kept, Ibrahim was there telling them, no, we have the right to be here just like everybody else. And they kept telling us, no, no. That was one cop. Another cop was on the phone trying to figure out how to get us out of there. And then eventually somebody remembered, I think it was Trillium, remembered that we had a hard copy of the ordinance that said everybody can pitch up their tent, no matter who. Also in that conversation, I forgot to mention, was that the organizers, Trillium, Ibrahim, and others, had called the city and asked, who can pitch up your tent or their tent? And they said, anybody. And they called the organizers of the Rose Parade, and they said, they asked them, who can pitch up their tents? And they said, anybody. So we did have that ordinance, and we showed the officer the ordinance, and he couldn't say anything because it was anybody could pitch up their tents. So a few minutes after that, or seconds after that, a business owner complained about homeless people being out there in front trying to scare off his customers. And the cop told them, no, they have the right to be here. They're waiting for the parade, the Rose Parade. And the whole business owner, manager, whatever he was just really complaining. And they went inside, and we could see him through the window, you know, the owner, whatever, complaining, his arms going all kinds of ways. And the cop kind of with his arms crossed saying, no, no, they have the right to be there. And eventually what happened was they stopped after a few minutes. And then when the cop came out, the assistant director, or DA, was standing right there by the door and said, what's going on? So the cops started all over. Okay, across the street, there's these homeless people. And we told them they couldn't be there. But then they have this hard copy that shows anybody can be there of the ordinance. And then he went into about this owner complaining about homeless people being in front of his business. And he wanted them on out, and he told them, I told them they have the right to be there because they're waiting for the parade. Anyway, so she's getting really upset. And then finally, she knows she can't do anything. So she pulls out her card, her business card, and hands it to the police officer and says, if there's any problems, give me a call. And then she goes storming on off. And then the cop, right after that, comes on out and says to the homeless people again, you got to leave. And Ibrahim went over and said, no, we got the right to be here. And they went back and forth again about arguing when, you know, our case of homeless people being there. And then finally, Ibrahim says, okay, so you're saying we have to leave? And the cop says, yeah. So Ibrahim points to these non-homeless people across the street in their tents and says, okay, you tell them to leave, and when they leave, then we'll leave. And so that's pretty much how it started on off within the first couple of hours of being there. Everything went great. We had a lot of great singers and great speakers. And yeah, we watched ourselves, and nothing really happened the whole night. But it's been getting bigger and bigger. More people are becoming aware of this double standard, you know, of letting people, non-homeless people, pitch their tents for leisure, but you can't pitch it to survive. And, you know, one of the biggest things I want to say, too, about that is, if you look in any kind of safety survival manual, you'll see that a tent, tarp, food, water is necessary surviving out there. And yet they want to take this away from homeless people. So, yeah, this is basically what this is about.
And the hardest thing, this is Ibrahim Mubarak, the hardest thing that we had was convincing the awareness of the houseless community that they wasn't going to be swept, they wasn't going to be criminalized and taken to jail because they were sleeping in a tent. So the first year, we only had like 2.5 blocks on both sides of 4th Avenue on the parade route. And then when they found out that they wasn't going to get swept, it got bigger and bigger. But a lot of people don't realize this is how Right to Survive found Right to Dream too, through this direct action where people saying that was good rest to have. So,
excuse me, interrupt for a second. Are you guys trying to recruit people to come to the event? Is that the main purpose?
Yes, we are. We're trying to have people to bring food, clothing, tents, sleeping bags,
When is the event going to take place?
The event takes place tomorrow morning, June 8th, from noon until midnight. We're going to start setting up around 10:30 because that's when the ordinance allows people to start putting tents down.
And where will you primarily be located?
On 4th and Southwest Washington.
And you don't have to be homeless in order to participate, is that right? Or houseless?
No, we welcome people, so we believe in shared space, and people need to learn to exist in the same space, exist and breathing the same air, and enjoying each other the same way where you enjoy anything.
Has there been, how many people do you normally attract to the event? Can you give us an idea?
Well, let's just say last year we had 10.5 blocks up and down 4th Avenue on both sides. And then we have a host of entertainers. We'll have Mike Crenshaw, Black Butterfly, Corinth, DJ Smurf. We're going to have people reading poems and guest speakers, Joanne Hardesty, Corey Daly, Sarah Inaret, Mike Crenshaw. You know, we're going to have a lot of people that volunteer to have the houseless community have enjoyment and peace at least one day out of the year.
Well, we know Mike because he works here sometimes at KABU, so we wish you well. Let's just repeat, this is from noon to midnight. That's tomorrow, June 8th, at 4th and Southwest Washington. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
Everybody's welcome.
It goes on. The camping out goes on until the next morning. So, yeah, we start from about 10:30 to the next morning when they break down the tent. So, yeah, we're going to be there that long. And, yeah, come talk to us. That's one of the biggest things I believe we should do is tell the homeless, non-homeless people, we're just like you. You know, we have our problems, yeah. But, you know, you can sleep next to us. You can come talk to us.
All right.
Don't be afraid of us.
We're about to run out of time, guys. Thank you so much for calling us up, and hope the event goes well.
No problem.
Yeah.
Good evening. The time is 5:58. You are listening to KBO Portland, and up next is Rose City Native Radio.
Join KABU Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for an evening of storytelling, live music, and film. Malian artist, author, and storyteller Baba Wage Jakite starts with a talk on the background of the Empire of Mali and the role of West Africa's oral historians before the screening of Keita, Heritage of the Griots, a film which blends modern events with magical realism, mythology, and history. Again, that's an evening of the culture of Mali, including the screening of the film Keita, Heritage of the Griots, on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Northwest Deaf Arts Festival on Saturday, June 16th at Mississippi Studios in Portland. The Northwest Deaf Arts Festival consists of a family-friendly matinee show as well as an adult-only 21 and over evening show. Performers include hip-hop artist Sean Forbes, dancer Antoine Hunter, poet Raymond Luzak, and more. Again, that's the Northwest Deaf Arts Festival on Saturday, June 16th at 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. Mississippi Studios is located at 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KABU.
You are listening to a digital indigenous radio show. All across Turtle Island, turn up your radios and decolonize. This is Rose City Native Radio.
Can you tell an Indian first?